We're gonna take a trip right now. Like we always do about this time.
This is a journey into sound. Break it
down. I'm Kyle Long, and you're listening to Cultural Manifesto. On this week's show, I'll speak with Rod Argent and Colin Blunstone of the legendary British rock band The Zombies. They'll be performing in Indiana on October 19th at the Brown County Music Center. The Zombies were formed in St. Albans, England during the early 1960s. Along with the Beatles and Rolling Stones, the Zombies were among the first English bands to hit the United States during the British invasion of the mid-1960s. But the Zombies were not your typical British invasion band. The jazz-influenced keyboard work of Rod Argent and the breathy vocals of Colin Blunstone provided the group with a unique and instantly recognizable sound. The Zombies split up around 1969 after releasing Odyssey and Oracle. Today, the album is considered a masterpiece of 1960s rock and roll. Odyssey and Oracle was largely a flop at the time of its initial release. But over the years, a large cult audience has formed around that album and the band. The Zombies have continued to tour and record in the 21st century. Their latest album is titled Different Game, and Rod Argent says the album is the Zombies' best work since Odyssey and Oracle.
Well, I feel that because we recorded it with exactly the same set of circumstances as we did Odyssey and Oracle.
Rod Argent will join me in a moment, but first, let's listen to a classic track from the Zombies. We'll hear the band's debut release, She's Not There, issued in 1964.
Please don't bother trying to find her. She's not there. Well, let me tell you about the way she looked, the way she had tan, the color of her hair. Her voice was soft and cool, her eyes were clear and bright, but she's not there.
That was The Zombies with their debut single, She's Not There, the top 10 hit for the group in 1964. I recently spoke with the band's keyboardist and songwriter, Rod Argent. He's had an extraordinary career in music. In addition to his work with The Zombies, Argent has found success in television as a composer. And during the 1970s, he led the eponymously named hard rock band Argent. Let's join my conversation with Rod Argent. Rod, it's an honor to have you on the program, and I'm grateful that you've taken time to join us today. So thank you.
Oh, it's a great pleasure, Carl. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you and the Zombies have some exciting new projects that I want to discuss. But first, if you don't mind, I want to ask a few questions about the band's early years. She's Not There was a massive breakout hit for you and the Zombies in 1964. I read recently somewhere that this was only the second song you'd ever written. And that just doesn't sound possible, but is that true?
It is true, yeah. I'd written a song. Actually, to be absolutely accurate, it was the third. But I'd forgotten, for many years, I'd forgotten I'd written the very first song. And my cousin, who later became the bass player with the Kinks on their biggest selling records and became founder member with me of Argent, was in a band way back in 1956. And it was a skiffle band. And then they became one of the bands with electric instruments, one of the first bands in the south of England with electric instruments. And I actually wrote way back then. In fact, a couple of years later than that, or two or three, I was 15, actually. No, I wasn't. I was 15. And I actually wrote this song and gave it to him. And I didn't realise for many years that his manager had got them to record it in Olympic Studios, which was one of the main London studios where the Stones recorded, all sorts of things. And I'd completely forgotten anything about that song. So for years, but that was, it was pretty derivative, that first song. And it's I don't think of that as the real proper first song that I wrote. So the very first song I wrote in my mind was It's All Right With Me. And we played that in a rock and roll competition that we won. As a result of that, we got a recording contract with Decca. Dick Rowe, the head of Decca, came backstage and said, we'd like you to record for Decca. So we went in to record. I wrote She's Not There for the session. So if you count It's All Right With Me as the first song I ever wrote, She's Not There was the second. And Chris White wrote the B-side, which was You Make Me Feel Good. So, you know, it was virtually the second song I ever wrote, yeah.
And your cousin's band, it was the Blue Tones, is that right?
You're absolutely right. It was the Blue Tones. They started out as a skiffle group.
Yeah.
And in fact, Jim, to the end of his life, could play a great string bass. In other words, just a piece of string and a T-chest. And he could put a mic in the tea chest, and get wonderfully accurate notes out of a piece of ordinary string and a broom handle. It's quite extraordinary, but I loved it, and yeah. and that was his band, yeah.
Yeah, they call it washtub bass here in the States.
Okay, yeah, okay. Yeah.
In addition to your great songwriting, one of the most striking elements of She's Not There is your keyboard work. You often incorporate really fascinating keyboard textures into your music, whether it's the Zombies, Argent, or your solo work as well. I think you were playing the Hohner Pianette, electric piano, on She's Not There. And this must have been among the first pop records, like major pop records, to feature an electric piano. Do you know if that's correct?
It was one of the first. I mean, I think that Manfred Mann had one. Whether it was used on his very early records, I'm not sure. I know that for me, finding the Hohner Pianette was an incredibly liberating experience, because up to then I just played on whatever piano was at a hall that we were playing at as a semi-pro group. And the only time you could ever hear me was when I did a Jerry Lee Lewis sort of gliss up and down the piano. Mm. And so I used to spend all night doing that. And it made my thumb bleed. So Colin always used to judge the success of a gig by how much blood I had on my thumb that had been taped up with, with a plaster. So when I first got the Hohner Pianette, suddenly I could hear what I was playing, and I could play improvisation. And it was just so freeing. It was a wonderful feeling for me. Very important moment.
Yeah, it's an incredible sound. And I think that's one of the things that made this record so unique, right? It was an influential record in that way, in terms of introducing the sound of the electric piano to a whole generation of rock musicians.
Well, yeah. And I think to some degree that was right, because I've had feedback from, I think it was McGuinn in the Byrds, said that Eight Miles High would never have been written without him hearing the sort of jazzy improvisation in the middle of She's Not There. That was a wonderful thing for me to hear. Yeah.
I wanted to ask about the jazz influence you brought to the group. A lot of my journalism is centered around the jazz history of Indianapolis. You know, Wes Montgomery,
wow.
J.J. Johnson, Freddie Hubbard, Slide Hampton, this entire generation of jazz greats came out of our city here.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, the jazz influence you brought to the Zombies was incredibly unique at that time. This was years before fusion and prog rock. You know, rock and roll was pretty straight at that time,
yeah,
in the mid-60s. I'm curious if you intentionally set out to create that sort of jazz component of the Zombies sound, or was this just an organic part of your playing and expression at that time?
It was totally organic. I mean, I thought that when I wrote She's Not There, I thought I was writing, a rock and roll, an early rock and roll, a beat group type of song. And even though I got turned onto rock and roll when I first discovered Elvis at the age of 11 years old with Hound Dog and Lordy Miss Claudie, and then which quickly led me into the rawest rock and roll I could hear from Little Richard and Joe Lee. And then that quickly led me to a lot of old blues things, which I was interested in. But I think that was a wonderful, wonderful time for music. And there was particularly, from a jazz point of view, I loved the very early lineup of Miles's band with John Coltrane and Cannonball Adderley, Philly Joe Jones, and then later Bill Evans. But Milestones was the record I heard, which was, I later realised, was Miles's very first attempt to introduce modal scales for soloing on. And I didn't know anything about modes, but I knew the sound of Milestones was something which I could not get enough of. And I can still sing you the Cannonball Adderley's opening solo on Milestones, and wow, and then Coltrane's thing, and most of Miles's phrases on that. I can remember it now. You know, you know, and so on. But I never thought of that being incorporated into what we were doing in any way. It was just music that I loved, along with many sorts of music, and actually classical music as well. But I just thought we were being a beat group, and I loved it, and I was totally involved in it. But I think all these influences were sort of swirling around, and they did get quite naturally incorporated into what we were doing, because I loved improvising. And suddenly I had this electric piano where you could hear the solo that I was playing. We were all playing that music for its own sake in those days. I mean, it wasn't for any thought of we have to make a record and be huge stars. It was, we're just in love with this music and playing the music. And the other musical influences that were on the periphery for me, but not part of the rock and roll group that I considered us to be, were still swimming around. And as you so correctly say, organically became part of what we were doing. It was, there was no way of that not happening, really, in a way. And I'm so pleased in retrospect, because I thought we were just being another beat group when we recorded She's Not There. But when I look back many years later, I think, my God, when I hear it, I think there was actually nothing else like this around at all. And it used to really confuse cameramen. I can't tell you. There are only two or three clips that I remember still in existence of our early TV stuff when we had a hit with She's Not There, for instance. But whenever it came to the piano solo, the cameras would go straight onto the drums or the guitar, even though, you know, it was the piano solo that I was playing. So, and that used to happen throughout all the earliest years. In the cameraman's view, rock and roll was guitars. And that's what, you know, they didn't understand anything else. But nevertheless, I loved incorporating that side of things quite naturally into what we were doing.
Yeah, you eventually made a couple full-on jazz albums during the 1980s. You recorded with Johnny Dankworth and Barbara Thompson. Was that something you always wanted to do, or was it just an opportunity that kind of came up when you had the time and interest to follow through?
It was both things were offered by the people you were talking about. Mm. And I loved using that side of my interest in a natural way with really, really good musicians. And then later on, I got to know John Dankworth very well because I lived just maybe 20 minutes drive away from John. And I was in that house for 38 years. And he became a close friend. And then one day he phoned me up and said, I've just been thinking, Rod, I'd love to make an album with you. I said, well, great, John. And he said, I've booked some time in 4 weeks' time. That'll give us time to write the material. And I thought, oh, my God, this is not the time scale I'm used to at all. But I had great fun working with him and got to know him. And he became a close friend right to the end of his life, actually. What a lovely man and a hugely talented musician as well.
I'm Kyle Long, and you're listening to Cultural Manifesto. If you're just tuning in, my guest is Rod Argent, the keyboardist and songwriter for The Zombies. We've been discussing the influence of jazz on the Zombies' music. And up next, we'll listen to a classic jazz-influenced track from the band. Released in 1965, this is the Zombies with I Want You Back Again.
Somebody help me, I've gotta eat. Somebody help me to stand on my feet. I want you back again. Oh, oh, oh. I want you back again.
That was The Zombies with I Want You Back Again. The Zombies will be performing in Indiana on October 19th at the Brown County Music Center. Last year, I spoke with Zombies vocalist Colin Blunstone. Let's listen back to an excerpt from our conversation. And The Zombies had such a different sound in contrast to the other British groups of that era. You know, in addition to the blues and rhythm and blues influences, there was a strong presence of jazz music. And of course, a lot of that came from Rod Argent's keyboard playing and songwriting. But I can hear it in your voice, too. And I'm curious if jazz music had a place in your life, or you were just sort of reacting to the material that Rod was bringing into the group.
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. Yeah. I think Rod was very influenced by jazz and still is. But also, we were all very interested in jazz. I think that one of the advantages that the Zombies had is that they did have a very different sound. They were influenced by so many different kinds of music, from classical music to jazz, the blues, rhythm and blues, rock and roll, and pop music. And that made us quite different, I think. But also it could be a bit of a problem because people didn't really know where to place us in, say, in radio, or in marketing. They weren't quite sure what kind of a band we were. We didn't really fit into a category. And that sometimes, it sounds a little bit strange to say that, but it can in some ways be a bit of a disadvantage. I mean, you can't do anything about it. If that's your natural musical makeup, then that's the way it is. But I think it was a little bit of a disadvantage for us, but it was also a huge advantage as well. I remember when we very first started, which was in 1961, we were one of the few bands that was a keyboard-based band and that also relied very heavily on three-part harmony. We always sang harmonies. And certainly no bands that I knew of in the UK at that time were featuring keyboards and harmonies. And again, that made us quite different as well. And that also had a disadvantage. When we first started out, I think it was harder for us to get local dances, gigs, whatever one would call it, because we didn't fit in with that three-guitar rock band image. We were just always slightly different. And with all things that are different, it's got its advantages and it's got its disadvantages.
Hmm. You know, one of the early songs the group recorded was Summertime. And, you know, you bring such a sensitive approach to interpreting that song, especially considering your age. You know, do you recall if you modeled that on any of the, you know, famous jazz interpretations of the song? Or, yeah, I'm just curious kind of if you were approaching this music at all from a jazz state of mind, or it was just more of an organic response to the music the band was playing.
Well, I mean, we were all listening to a lot of jazz, and especially Rod has been a lifelong fan of Miles Davis. So there is a lot of Miles in how Rod writes. I'm not saying that he copies Miles or anything like that. He's just influenced by him. But that particular song is what we would call a jazz waltz, I think. And from memory, that a friend of Chris White's, who was the bass player, original bass player in the Zombies, he was called Duffy Coke, and he went to my school actually, and he used to play Summertime as a jazz waltz, and I think we kind of stole that from this guy, Duffy Kirk. He was never even a professional musician. He was a very good artist, but he wasn't a professional musician. From memory, that's where the idea of that song came from. And it was one of the first things we ever recorded on our first session at Decca Studios. And I remember quite recently, Rod said, you know, let's do Summertime again. We hadn't done it for some time. And he wanted to do it in a completely different way. And it was so difficult for me anyway. I'm used to that jazz waltz feel to it. And he played it in a totally different way with different chords and very little rehearsal. I don't even know if we ran through it in rehearsal. And it was so difficult to sing it in a different way. But at the moment, we're not playing it at the moment. And I think if we're going to play it in a new way, I think I'm quite relieved, actually, because I've got that original arrangement in my head. And I think I would prefer to play it that way. One of the first TVs we ever did, we did She's Not There and Summertime. And so it's a little bit nerve-wracking because it was a live TV. And they wanted me to climb up this really high ladder when I sang Summertime. So not only I was sort of just about 19, I think, at the time, still quite young. I was very inexperienced. I don't think I'd ever been on TV before, and I don't like heights. So I had to go up this really high ladder and sing Summertime live on TV with a live audience moving around underneath me and just jiggling this ladder that I was on. So I'll always remember that. The show was Ready, Steady, Go. It was on a Friday night live in London.
It's summertime and living is easy. The fields are jumping and the cotton is high. Your dad is rich and your mama's good looking. Won't you hush, pretty baby, don't you cry.
Cultural Manifesto will return with more words and music from the Zombies after this short break. I'm Kyle Long, and you're listening to Cultural Manifesto. On this week's show, we're exploring the music of the legendary British rock band The Zombies. They'll be performing in Indiana on October 19th at the Brown County Music Center. Up next, we'll listen to one of the band's most iconic songs. Released in 1968, this is The Zombies with Time of the Season.
It's the time of the season when love runs high. In this time, give it to me. Let me try with pleasured hands
to take you in this time to
promised lands,
to show you everyone it's the time of the season for love.
That was The Zombies with Time of the Season. That track was featured on the band's 1968 album, Odyssey and Oracle. Odyssey and Oracle is commonly listed as one of the greatest albums in rock music. Let's return to my conversation with The Zombies' keyboardist and songwriter, Rod Argent, as we discuss the legacy of Odyssey and Oracle. You've made so much music during your career. You know, you had huge hits with Argent in the 70s. You know, you made these jazz records. You had a significant career as a composer. But so much of your legacy, I think, has been centered around The Zombies' Odyssey and Oracle album. From what I understand, the album was somewhat of a flop at the time of its initial release in 1968. Over the years, though, it's developed this massive audience of music fans. It's frequently named as one of the best albums of all time. It reaches new generations of listeners every year. I'm curious what you make of the album's enduring appeal. Do you have a sense of what it is that makes it such a a timeless classic? Did you think you were making a masterpiece back in 1967 when you recorded it? Is this all a mystery to you, or do you have a sense of why this has been so enduring?
Well, I really think that the way, right from the my first involvement with any sort of group, which was the Zombies, back in when I was 15 years old, and that's when I first met Colin, whatever we did it for real. We did it for the right reasons. You know, of course, we wanted to be successful commercially, but that was never the driving force in anything that we did. It's always, we always wanted to be able to express ourselves in the most exciting way possible for us, and the thought that we could be working within music in this wonderful milieu, that we were so lucky to be able to earn a living by working with what we loved. And everything that we did for real. I mean, for instance, if I wrote a song and we worked it up, we would never think, I would never think, okay, I have to get to a hook line in 30 seconds because otherwise it won't stand a chance. I never thought in that way at all. I mean, I wanted it to be played as much as possible, but I just wanted it to really work. And I thought in the end, if you can write something that to some degree means something to yourself, that moves you in the slightest way, then you stand a chance of being able to communicate that somehow on the record with other people who might then go out and be moved to actually spend what at the time was 6 shillings and 8 pence on their of their hard-earned money or their hard-to-get money, you know, because there wasn't a lot of money around, and they'd have to really want to sacrifice something, to buy something. So if you could actually move somebody in any way, you know, that has to start with you feeling you've really made something work yourself, and you're excited yourself about what you've done. And that's the way we still feel now when Colin and I work together on something. It's always with the feeling of the way to be successful in a way and for things to last is for you to really mean what you're doing and really, really be involved in a real way. You have to continue to try and excite yourself with a musical idea. And that's always been the fulcrum, if you like, of what we've done. And in some ways, I think that's worked against us because it meant that people were used to hearing certain things that radio would pick up on, and we wouldn't necessarily give them that. In fact, even from She's Not There, and certainly with She's Not There, Teleno, and Time of the Season, the record companies themselves liked them, but they didn't really think they were commercial. And yet, She's Not There turned out to be a number one single in Cashbox. It turned out to be just the second song from an English band with a self-written song after the Beatles to top the American charts. So you can't get more commercial than that. But it's only because we did something we really believed in. And if something's a bit off kilter, then sometimes it doesn't get instantaneous recognition. But it can stand a chance of really spanning the years, you know. And we play now, when we play, we normally have young people in the audience, really quite a component of young people who are maybe in their early 20s, sometimes even younger, along with people that have followed us all the way through. You know, it's a real mixture, but there's usually a young component in the audience that somehow are relating to the songs that I wrote or Chris White wrote or whatever, and the Zombies performed when we were 18 and 20 years old. And I think they have lasted. And I include Time of the Season and Odyssey and Oracle with that. Mm. Because again, we were doing it purely for real, to make the best record we could, to express them the most interesting ideas for ourselves on record, and to try and to get the best working emotions and melodically things that work best musically for ourselves. And I think in the short term, sometimes meant we didn't get instant hits. It meant that record companies would often like the records that we did, but wouldn't think they were commercial. And yet, She's Not There was number one. Teleno was number five. And I'm just talking about singles over a 3-year period here that we recorded. And Time of the Season, again, was number one
pretty much all over the world except for the UK, where it has never hit. And these days, we still all the time get people of a young age still being able to relate to that. These things have really lasted, and they're used in many films and TV programs in many areas. And it's so satisfying to feel that. And I honestly think that you've got to, in the end, be true to yourself. And I think that's the secret for so much in life. And if you're true to yourself, then you stand a chance of being satisfied to some extent with what you've done. So when we were making Odyssey and Oracle, it wasn't with the thought of this has to be a huge success. It's just we've got to get our own ideas and produce something for the first time of ourselves, so we get our own ideas of how our song should sound on record. And that's the philosophy we carry on to the present day. When we've just made the album that we have, Different Game, we recorded with exactly the same criteria. It was to play for real. That's what we do on stage. We play to make the best concert we can with the band musicians and enjoy ourselves musically, because it's such a privilege to be able to earn your living that way.
Let's take a break from my conversation with Rod Argent and listen to another classic track from Odyssey and Oracle. This is The Zombies with Care of Cell 44. That was The Zombies with Care of Cell 44. This week on Cultural Manifesto, we're exploring the music of the legendary British rock band The Zombies. They'll be performing in Indiana on October 19th at the Brown County Music Center. Let's return to my conversation with The Zombies' keyboardist and songwriter, Rod Argent, as we discuss The Zombies' latest album, Different Game. And Rod, I want to ask about your new album with The Zombies, Different Game. It's an exceptional album, and it's filled with amazing keyboard sounds from you. That's one of the things that I loved most about the album, is just hearing all these great keyboard textures. I believe you've called this album The Zombies' best work since Odyssey and Oracle. Tell me about that, and what inspired you to make that comment?
Well, I feel that because we recorded it with exactly the same set of circumstances as we did Odyssey and Oracle. The reason we did Odyssey and Oracle was that we'd become very frustrated with how our recent singles have been sounding, because it just wasn't how the songs that Chris White and I wrote in our heads. They didn't turn out that way on once they were recorded. So we thought we had to produce an album ourselves to make that happen if we could. And we had no idea whether we could make that happen or not. But it was the first music that we'd been totally in control ourselves of recording. And we did feel at the end of that album that the songs that Chris and I had written separately, that we'd managed to get what was in our heads very largely onto what tape, as it was at the time. With Different Game, the same set of circumstances. We felt that the band had never sounded so good live. We've been working a lot live in America, leading up particularly to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction. And we couldn't wait to get back and record the new album. And I wanted to produce it. I'd written 9 of the 10 songs. So I really wanted to, for better or worse, I wanted to get my own ideas as closely as I could into how the song should sound, from where I started in my mind, how I envisaged them. And I think very largely we accomplished that. You know, you never get anything 100%, but I feel the same set of circumstances were involved in recording this album as we're recording Odyssey and Oracle. And also, we very deliberately went back to an old way of recording, because in the old days, there was no other way of doing it but to play live together, not to turn your back on any studio techniques, but so that you could play in the jazz tradition of playing off whatever else was going on in the room. And, you know, so when I was playing, it affected how the drums were being played, and the drums were responding to what I was playing. And similarly with the bass player and the guitarist in the band, who I think are all wonderful musicians. And Colin would be singing a live guide vocal, which actually in the end turned out more often than not to be the basis of the master vocal. You know, it was as live as you could make it within a recording studio situation. It really was. That it's not a live album, but all the performances were basically, each track was really recorded typically in maybe 3 or 4 hours. And that, and I'm not to say that we didn't add touches afterwards, but only in a very small way. We didn't even double track most of the vocals. It was only on Rediscover that I particularly wanted a certain effect and sound with an a cappella harmony thing over the opening 8 bars, that we double track the vocals. I mean, before that, I think just about everything on the album was as live as you can imagine it, you know, single track. So everyone was listening to everybody else, having a ball creating the track. It was basically came together in about 4 hours. So it wasn't stale. And then at the same time, you managed to get that thing that you can't get if you record separately or doing it one track at a time or with a click. You capture something of the spirit of the band, and you might end up with 4 or 5 takes that you think are really good. But if you're lucky, one of those takes suddenly gels and becomes something which is more than the sum of its parts. And that's a little bit of magic. And that's the sort of magic of making music. Certainly the magic of jazz. I mean, your interest in jazz, you know, even right back to the days of Art Tatum, when Rachmaninoff used to listen to him and say, if you play classical music, we'd all be in trouble. You know, real musicians listen to great music of all kinds, I think, and involve it in what they're doing and are not snobbish about it. So so I think that A Different Game had, you know, a lot of the same criteria going for it as Odyssey and Oracle did. And it's a different album. It's with the current lineup of the band. But Colin and I loved making it, and we loved performing it on stage too.
Let's take a break from my conversation with Rod Argent and listen to a track from The Zombies' latest album, Different Game. This is The Zombies with I Want to Fly.
I just must break free, 'cause I want to fly, leave the ordinary world and say goodbye, kiss the earth and make a wish and say
that was The Zombies with I Want to Fly. Let's return to my conversation with The Zombies' keyboardist and songwriter, Rod Argent. Finally, The Zombies will be performing here in Central Indiana at the Brown County Music Center on October 19th. Anything you want to say to our listeners about this show before we go?
No, I just hope we give you a good performance. It's one of the early it's not that early actually it's not that early within the tour, so no, we should be well over jet lag by that time. So I think the band should be on full song, and I have to say that for that, it, you know what, it's such a privilege being able to continue music to this age, because you really do feel for those you know, maybe hour and three quarters or whatever it is that you're on stage, it feels no different to when you were 18 years old. And the energy and the love of what you're doing and playing with other guys and producing the result, there really is no different to when you were 18. It might be a very different story when you finish the gig or before you go on. You know, you have to save your energies for that. But, you know, to be able to enjoy that and at this age is like no other profession in the world, I think.
Our listeners can find more information at thezombiesmusic.com. Rod, I can't thank you enough for taking time to do this today. I'm a massive fan of everything you've done, so it was an extraordinary honor to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, bless you, Carl. Thank you so much.
One final reminder. The Zombies will be performing live in Indiana on October 19th at the Brown County Music Center. Let's end with another track from Odyssey and Oracle. This is Hung Up on a Dream. Check out the Cultural Manifesto podcast on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Cultural Manifesto is hosted and produced by me, Kyle Long. Thank you for listening.